Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Probably no surprise, but I'm not exactly going to go according to the lineup on the agenda. We're going to hear from Chris Olenek on House Bill 2075 first, and then we're going to do our work sessions before we get back to the top of the agenda. So, just so you know.
Thanks, Bill.
So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2075. And Chris, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Chris Olenek, Legislative Revenue Office. And I was asked to come and talk about, I guess, largely the tax credit process. The credit you have before you is a corporate excise tax credit equal to the amount of fire insurance premiums tax paid. But the process for tax credit review, and this will, like, for veteran members, this will sound familiar. For freshmen, this will probably be pretty new. But the state has, for this session, about 15 tax credits that are scheduled to sunset this biennium. And the legislature, over the past few years, has established a process for evaluating these tax credits. It's basically a policy check-in, if you will. So the bill before you is an example of bills that simply extend the tax credit, a given tax credit, 6 years. They're basically placeholder bills, and these bills are farmed out to the policy committees to check in on the policy and evaluate the policy to decide if the credit is meeting its purpose, if what should that purpose be, if it should be changed. And I believe Jan has handed out some questions that are designed to help facilitate that process. And it really is just to the extent that the chair and the committee would like to get into the weeds on the given policy. It's an evaluation of the policy, setting aside the revenue cost to the tax credit. That's kind of the second step. But the policy committee evaluates it and can modify it in any way, can decide that it should be allowed to sunset, can extend it 6 years, and can change it in any way as it sees fit. And that recommendation, the bill, will be encapsulated in whatever form the bill will take, the amendments, and then the bill will be sent down to JTAX, where the Joint Committee on Tax Credits will collect all of the tax credit bills that make it out of the policy committees, and basically follows a ways and means kind of like process, where it looks at the revenue impact question for all of the tax credits and how much can be spent on the tax credits, and then proceeds accordingly. Depending on if there is enough money or if changes need to be made to the policies to fit them into the revenue constraints. So at a very high level, that's the process. LRO staff is available to the extent you would like to make use of us for this process. I mean, we try to always be there to be helpful, but this is kind of an explicit role for the tax credits.
So that's the process, you know, for the committee, especially the new members, that, you know, we do look at the policy behind this tax credit and then make recommendations to the tax credit committee. And, Chris, I don't know if you're prepared to give us any background on this particular tax credit, or is that...
Sure, I can. I'm not sure who's testified this. I don't want to repeat things, but I can certainly give it...
You are the first one. We wanted to get you up first to describe what we're supposed to be doing. And
Well, this particular tax credit is for insurance companies. And insurance companies will pay the corporate excise tax or the corporate income tax, and they will also pay, among other things, the fire insurance premium tax. For the amount of the fire insurance premium tax that they pay, they are allowed a tax credit against their corporate income tax. So it's basically a funding mechanism for directing general fund dollars as a way to fund the Office of the State Fire Marshal. So in that sense, it's a little bit different from other tax credits where there's an incentive to encourage businesses or individuals to undertake some sort of behavior or investment function where there might be an evaluation of jobs created or investment, amount of investment, that kind of thing. This is more of a funding mechanism that the legislature has chosen as a way to direct general fund dollars to the Office of the State Fire Marshal. I mean, at the core and its simplest, that's the policy description there.
All right. I'm sure we'll have the information on how big it is and how much money is involved in this.
It's in the neighborhood of $4 million a year. Mm-hmm. Now, the revenue impact, there are some nuances to that that I don't know if the committee wants to get into on the revenue impact side, because it interacts with other taxes that exist.
So will we be seeing a revenue and fiscal impact statement out of this committee before it goes to the Joint Tax Credit Committee?
I can produce what we call a revenue light, so you will have an idea of that dollar impact.
Yeah, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair and committee members, on the staff measure summary, I described the tax credit, how it worked, the fact that it was established in 1969, but I chose to leave off discussion of the value of the tax credit in the idea that this committee is looking at the policy of it, and it's the joint tax credit that chooses to look and weigh it against other tax credits and the size. If you choose, I can include that information on the staff measure summary the next time around.
Okay. And do you know the history of why they decided to fund the State Fire Marshal's Office this way instead of just directly out of the general fund?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I don't. I did do, in preparation for, or in putting together the report, I did go back through legislative history. And unfortunately, the why is often can be elusive as to why it was done this way as opposed to other options. I don't know. I don't have the short answer is I don't know. I don't have a clear answer.
Well, that's good. So questions from the committee for Chris, because I'm going to turn him loose.
I have a comment.
A comment?
I do.
Okay.
I feel smarter when he's in the room. That's all. Big brain guy. I always feel smarter.
All right. Well, anything we can do to help that.
No, I need to help.
So,
get your head.
All right. You're off the hook for now. We'll let you know if we have more questions. Thanks. So, committee, I'm going to. Yes, we might as well go ahead and have Eric Gablick and Jim Walker and John Powell.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Gablick, I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I believe State Fire Marshal Walker and I can answer some of the questions about what this fund does, and then John can probably talk about the insurance partnership. The history of the fire service with the insurance industry goes back to the era of Ben Franklin. If you've ever gone to Philadelphia, there used to be fire marks on buildings, and those fire marks would determine if the first volunteer fire department that arrived on a fire would get paid by the insurance company for putting out the fire. Now, our relationship is much different today with the insurance industry, but it's still stronger than ever. The insurance industry works with DPSST to ensure our firefighters across the state, both career and volunteer, are trained to national standards. They want those firefighters to be equipped, they want them to be well prepared, and they want to be efficient as they put out fires across the state. The insurance industry also funds our certification program, which benchmarks against those national standards. It funds the Office of State Fire Marshal, and it also funds the Oregon State Police Arson Section. So that's the dollars that it generates. And then Jim's going to talk about how much that brings in and then some of the details about the fund.
Chair Holvey, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Walker, and I'm the Oregon State Fire Marshal. Eric's mentioned, we actually started out in 1917 with the insurance industry, with our purpose being to reduce the risk to loss of property and life. We stayed within the insurance industry for a number of years before we kind of moved into other types of organizations. The fund generates about $25 million for our office, and that helps to fund the arson unit as well as the firefighter training, which was mentioned. Between 11,000 and 13,000 firefighters are funded by that. We use it for mobilizations to conflagrations for wildland-urban interface fires. That would typically be paid for by the general fund without that fire insurance premium tax to fund at least a pretty significant portion of that. We also use it for our fire and life safety program, which is our 15 deputies that are placed out amongst various offices around the state. A majority of those are in areas that do not have fire marshals, and so they're the ones that do the fire investigations as well as the inspection services. Funds our prevention program, which helps to provide prevention resources to communities as well as local fire departments where they could be able to fund those things themselves. Out of our office, it's about 40 positions. I think overall, if you were to take a look at the positions at DPSST as well as the arson unit, it's about 70 positions that those monies fund. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thanks. We'll go ahead and listen to Mr. Powell. Maybe he can provide us a little history as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Not saying you're as old as this program.
I was going to say, well, when Ben Franklin and I approached the legislature.
We learned it together.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Powell. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies that pay the fire marshal tax. And I think the preceding witnesses gave you a good enough sketch of the history of the tax and the former relationship with the insurance industry. And I think that's how it came to be funded by the insurance industry, because it used to be housed in the insurance industry. And so when it was moved to the government side of the equation, this method of funding followed it. And that's why, as the Legislative Revenue Office staff said, it's an unusual tax credit. It's different. And that's probably why the governor recommended keeping it in this budget cycle. It's 1.15% of fire premium, and then each form of insurance that includes some fire in it has a lesser degree, for example, 60% of a homeowner's policy, because in the homeowner's policy you have coverage against theft and liability insurance and that sort of thing. You get down to marine and aircraft, it's 8% of the premium on those things because there's some fire coverage provided. So that's the format of
the tax. Excuse me, John, just a minute. You know, I know there's a gentleman in the front aisle that's being very distracting for the committee to listen to the testimony. It's kind of important to us to pay attention. So if you can, I guess, not be doing all the gestures, I'd appreciate it.
That's not my son, is it? And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the tax then is collected by DCBS, which is, again, a little bit unusual, I think, and is forwarded to the Office of Fire Marshal, which then forwards part of it on to the training agency for fire training. It's fairly simple in that we did tweak it a few years ago to increase it slightly because of the pressure of financing on state agencies and the insurance industry stepped forward and agreed to increase this tax for this purpose, and it goes beyond just a direct benefit to the insurance company. It covers conflagration, which is beyond homeowners and things like that. So it is a broader benefit to the general public in Oregon than just returning things to the insurance industry. And to the extent they do prevent fires and save lives, that results in lower premiums for consumers in the long run. So it's a good partnership. It's a good way to fund good work. If Ralph Groner was here, he'd be up here with his union hat on supporting it. So we urge the committee to pass this bill on to the next step in the process.
Right. Questions from the committee. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. John, you referred to it as a tax, and it's just written as a tax credit, you know, and I don't think of a tax credit being a tax.
Yeah.
So this is just a tax on the premiums that go to the fire marshal.
Right. Right. Chair Olvey and Representative Barreto, that's correct. It is a tax credit for the tax paid.
Other questions? Well, it might let you off the hook. We'll take your testimony under consideration. Definitely, you know, I think any one of the committee members will likely get a hold of you in the future if we have questions, as we probably will bring this back and look at it again once we get a little more background on it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2075 and open a work session on House Bill 2337.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that was before you February 6th and February 22nd. It's a bill that comes from the Department of Consumer and Business Services and increases the minimum and the maximum workers' compensation benefits for the permanent total disability and permanent partial disability benefit. There's no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has been issued, and this is a measure that had the support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee with the Dash 1 Amendment. And the Dash 1 Amendment, also from the agency, it deletes the proposed increase to the permanent partial disability benefit to the worker who is released to return to work or the worker has returned to work. So it is only, so the bill with the Dash 1 Amendment is only affecting the permanent total disability.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, would you like to make a motion?
Chair Olby, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2337.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2337. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment? The amendment's adopted. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2337 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2337 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Doherty?
Aye. Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes. Okay.
Representative Fahey?
Yes.
Representative Pack?
Yes.
Representative
Kerr?
Aye.
Representative
Penimer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2337 passes. Carrier? Where was I at in my lineup for carriers?
Oh. Is that it?
Chair?
Are we working everything now? I need to testify on a bill. Should I hold off for
How long do you think you'll? Well, let's finish this first. Carrier, okay. Representative Barreto, thanks. Will be the carrier. So, close the work session on House Bill 2337 again, and committee. Given that Representative Hack will be leaving, maybe we'll go back to public hearing.
Thank you.
And you have a...
I'll be fast.
Okay, great. So, let's see, what do we want to...
Steve is here to speak.
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2191, which was carried over from Monday's agenda. And we had a few more people left to testify. Jesse O'Brien, I think we left off with you, and we could go ahead and get Nancy Hatch and Josie Coney. Excuse me if I spell your names. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director with OSPERG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We are a statewide consumer advocacy group, we are here excitedly in support of taking action this legislative session to stop the abuse of anonymous shell corporations in Oregon. We think this legislation may need a little technical work to ensure that it meets its objectives, but we think it's critical to take action this session to protect Oregon citizens' consumers and taxpayers from scams and criminal activity and lost revenue due to tax evasion, all of which are enabled by Oregon's current incorporation laws, which allow these anonymous shell corporations to proliferate kind of like crazy in the state, as we saw in the testimony from law enforcement on Monday. And I won't go through my full written testimony. It is on OLIS. I will mention that I entered a fact sheet on OLIS as well that contains a few of the worst examples that we've seen of the abuse of anonymous shell corporations in Oregon for illicit activity, some of which have been involved in tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of illegal activity in the state. And what I'll mention is just that these are the examples that we know about. But the problem is exactly that we don't know what's going on here, and it can be very difficult for law enforcement to get to the bottom of really where the money's going and who's involved and who's responsible for some of the criminal activity that is involved in these anonymous shell corporations. And I will emphasize that this legislation is not intended to and hopefully will not have the effect of making incorporation or regulatory oversight any more complicated for legitimate Oregon businesses. The intent is really to provide law enforcement with the tools they need to identify and stop bad actors. We know that there are some business owners that may have some legitimate concerns about privacy and making their ownership information available to the general public in certain situations. And the bill addresses that by making the information available only to the Secretary of State's office and to law enforcement. I'll just briefly mention that while we do strongly support this legislation, we hope it can move forward this session. We do have a few concerns about the current wording, and we recommend pursuing some technical amendments to ensure that it meets its objectives. And I have detailed comments about that in my written testimony, but I'll just mention one thing, which is that in the legislation, there are two options for companies revealing their ownership information under the rules of this bill. One is to file beneficial owner information with the Secretary of State. The other is to either submit an Oregon tax return or say that you will submit an Oregon tax return. And the problem with that last option is that a lot of these anonymous shell corporations are kind of fly-by-night operations that may be around for significantly less than a year, and this could give them as much as a year to do this kind of business with impunity, and then just never file a tax return, and then they're gone, and we have no way of tracing them back. So we would support amending this to a system that wasn't so reliant on the tax system. We think there are some other ways to try to lessen the perceived burden of filing beneficial ownership information for legitimate Oregon businesses, and I have a few suggestions in my testimony, but we're happy to work with anyone who has technical concerns about this bill. I just really hope that we can move this bill this year. Thank you.
You bet.
Good afternoon or morning, wherever we are. My name is Nancy Hatch. I am representing Jubilee Oregon, which is a chapter of Jubilee USA, which is a faith-based organization. Jubilee's focus is financial justice, including tax justice. Jubilee knows that shell companies play a significant role in enabling businesses to engage in tax avoidance and especially tax evasion. Jubilee is concerned about the ethical issue of certain businesses paying their fair share of taxes while others do not. Jubilee is also very concerned about how shell companies play a role in decreasing revenue. Also of concern to Jubilee is that the way that shell companies do other things, such as enabling corrupt government leaders to secretly take money out of their countries for personal benefit, often to buy luxury real estate without being detected. Jubilee supports 2191 because of its positive impact on tax equity and its ability to bring in more revenue for the state of Oregon. I should also note that Jubilee also has the same concerns about the option to use tax information as a way of trying to get to the beneficial owner, that is not a realistic way to do it, and that the beneficial owner should be a requirement. And I went and just glanced. I got it online. The document that you fill out to incorporate in Oregon, and you know, I was trying to think what would be the equivalent if you were to think of a driver's license, and it's sort of what came up to me is, you know, that getting your driver's license, you're asked for a name, you could put down your childhood nickname, you could put a P.O. box down, and what you claim is your emergency contact, and, you know, the police pull you over, and they're like, oh, there's this name, and the P.O. box person, you're like, who is this person? How do I get them a ticket? You know, I don't know. I even if I get this information, I can't verify it. So that's, I think it's, and I would also mention when I explain the situation to people, a lot of times the response to be seems to be, why wouldn't you have the beneficial owner of a company put down on documentation having to do licenses? You know, in every other situation, the main person involved in whatever they're being licensed to do is required to have their name. I looked at the licensing. If you want to go fishing or hunting in Oregon, you have to give your social security number. I think at this point in time, it becomes a why not have that vital information, particularly now understanding the sort of activities that it leads to. And I would quickly add that in addition to the sort of consumer fraud that the Department of Justice brought to you, it's also known that shell corporations enable things like terrorist activities, terrorist organization to go undiscovered, as well as human trafficking, drug trafficking, just about anything illegal you can mention that you would want to do to get funding for and not be discovered, you can do it with a shell corporation.
Thank you.
Chair Hulvey, Vice Chair Bynum, and Barreto, members of the Labor Committee, Business and Labor Committee. My name is Josie Kerner. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon, and I've submitted some testimony on Monday, and I'm going to skip parts of the need for the bill and just talk about the bill a little bit. You know, in Bill 2191 is designed by the Secretary of State's office to combat the fraud that the shell companies in Oregon have been doing since 2006. And most recently, the Business Journal says that Oregon is among the worst at policing the formation of shell companies, thanks to light regulatory touch and commitment to quickly processing incorporation requests and relatively low costs. This is Matt Kish. He's done some really excellent investigative reporting for Portland Business Journal. This bill forcefully addresses such abuse by requiring clearer identification of owners, agents and directors, beneficiaries, at the time of incorporation and the company's physical address, not just the mail forwarding address, that thwart law enforcement when companies commit financial and other crimes. It also requires higher annual fees that will help defray the costs to investigate any such activity. On Friday, March 5th, the business Portland Business Journal reported Davis Wright Tremaine, partner of Mark C. Phillips, is saying that HB 2191 would add unnecessary sand into the transmission of forming a company. Is filing a paper with the Secretary of State's office merely stating the names, addresses, and contact information of the registered agent of a corporation or LLC and company owners, paying an annual fee of $500 annual licensing fee, and a few other requirements about work locations and employees, and all that difficult, time-consuming, and onerous that they won't want to do business in Oregon? That's absurd. Corporations, considering what's at stake in terms of the consequences of fraud, that's a small price to pay to enable law enforcement to track down such costly illegal activity. Phillips also states, why does anyone believe that someone who is willing to set up these shell companies to do nefarious things is going to suddenly come into the sunshine? Of course they won't. They will file the articles and make certification using a made-up name, since the Secretary of State is neither required nor will have the resources to investigate. It's just going to create a pile of documents with certifications that are not worth anything. By this logic, we should not have stop signs, or as you say, require driver's licenses, because bad drivers will run stop signs anyway and steal cars. That's not great logic. House Bill 2191 would give the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's Office more investigative powers and increased authority to take legal action against such illicit companies. I would like to add here that there may be too few or too many requirements by this bill to incorporate or to change ownership or make changes in business scope, as Steve Elzinga and Chris Hall suggested in Monday's testimony. Perhaps this will not adequately address this fraud issue, but these issues can be statutory amendments as time goes on, or made even before the bill goes into effect in January. But as I understand it, the Secretary of State, Jean Atkins, had a good team working on devising this legislation in consultation with several federal agencies. Ownership names and the agents and beneficiaries and actual physical addresses and locations were the key elements they cited as needed by law enforcement to track shell company fraud. This bill addresses this problem and helps law enforcement. Sure, we can wait to come up with a perfect bill designed by all stakeholders as suggested Monday, or we can wait for the federal government agencies or the IRS to come up with a better, more comprehensive 50-state solution, or it can become a leader in requiring such disclosure and have other states follow suit. Usually good ideas originate at the state level. If we wait to act, how many more such abuses will continue to harm Oregonians? We need this bill now. We urge you to pass HB 2191 and remember Winston Churchill's words, perfection is the enemy of progress. And another saying, perfection is the enemy of the good. Tax Fairness Oregon wholeheartedly supports 2191.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations on this subject. Thanks. Up next, let's have Anthony Smith and Iris Hodge and Cheryl Hemster. Could you come back up as well? Anthony, let's start with you.
Sure. Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents nearly 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns with you about House Bill 2191. I'll try to be very brief with my comments today. I think the proponents of the bill did a pretty good job describing the problem, especially on Monday. We saw some good information. But they didn't really describe what the bill does or how it works. And I think that all of us would agree that finding abuse is terribly important, but also very important is how we go about finding abuse. And I think this bill takes an approach that isn't specifically aimed at the bad actors, but rather it casts a wide net that requires action to be taken by all Oregon businesses, even the ones that are clearly legitimate businesses that no reasonable person would ever accuse of being a shell corporation. So for those reasons expressed by even some of the bill's supporters, as well as some of the comments you heard from the Secretary of State's office, specifically with the interest of amendments in mind, NFIB would request that the committee give us time to work with other stakeholders to ensure that the good guys, the honest and legitimate small businesses, are not unnecessarily impacted by this legislation in an attempt to catch the bad guys. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I want to say I stand in solidarity with all the legislators wearing red on International Women's Day, whether you intended to or not. Thank you. It makes me feel great. Today, I want to give the sort of the other side of the business argument. My name is Iris Hodge. I'm the outreach coordinator for Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We're supporting HB 2191 because we believe it's right for business. We are a network of about 3,500 small businesses across the state. I've submitted written testimony, you probably saw on Monday, from a member of ours, Rosalind McCallard. She's a wholesale sandwich maker. She's in support of this, but she had to run her very small business. Oregon has a problem with shell corporations right here in our own backyards. These companies are often imposing high costs to Oregon's small business owners by robbing the state's government of billions of dollars in tax revenue. Requiring the collection of information on who owns and controls these companies would make it much harder for shell companies to launder dirty money, in turn leveling the playing field for Oregon's Main Street businesses and sharing the cost of doing business in Oregon. When we allow these companies to hide behind shell corporations rather than doing what's right and operating in a transparent manner, everyone suffers. Lastly, we don't believe this legislation will hinder innovation or disclose potential private ventures. It's about doing what's right for local economies, and passing HB 2191 is a good step towards making large corporations be held accountable for their business practices, just like Main Street businesses do. Main Street Alliance of Oregon urges you to support HB 2191 with amendments addressed by Jesse O'Brien from Augsburg, and thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to pause for a minute, see if people have questions for this panel.
Hi.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, or Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Smith. So you talked about the desire to have more conversations so that this bill doesn't unduly affect small businesses. Talk about an idea about how you would target this bill so that it only dealt with people who are actually breaking the law.
Sure. So, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey, you know, when I was reading through the bill, it's like a 35-page bill, and as I was reading through it, I had more questions than I thought it provided answers. And, you know, I started thinking about the mom-and-pop small business that's been, you know, on Main Street for 50 years. Nobody would question that they're a legitimate business operation, and yet under the bill, they would still be required to fill out some additional paperwork and re-register with the Secretary of State and provide some additional information. So, you know, whether it's the mom and pop shop on Main Street or the Capitol Cafe in the basement, you know, everybody knows that that's a legitimate business organization, and I would just like to take another look and see if there might be an opportunity for us to think about that and whether or not those types of businesses would need to be included in what the bill's trying to get at.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you do that in the bill? I mean, you know, you say everyone knows that this is a legitimate business. I mean, how on earth could you decide, could we determine, like, before the law is applied that this is a legitimate business and this is not?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey, I think that's a great question, and I think that I would love to go down that road and talk about it more.
Fair enough.
And I'm sure we'll provide that opportunity as well. So, Ms. Cheryl, I know you've already testified, and I didn't. You can add something if you like, but I do have a question for you. So, before you answer, you can give us your name. But I know the Secretary of State, you know, made some comments that there's been some changes around beneficial ownership at the federal level, evidently, and didn't see Oregon as being a huge problem as it was in, well, I think, 2006 or 2007. And as you know, we've, you know, followed this issue for at least 10 years in this building, trying to say, when is it time for Oregon to do something about it? Because Oregon back then was ranked one of the easiest to establish a shell corporation. I think second or third easiest. And since that time, Oregon's taken no action on this. And so I'm wondering how we move to, I think we referred to the middle of the pack, sort of, you know, on this. And I couldn't, you know, I'm going to ask the Secretary of State for, you know, that background, too, because I'm trying to figure out what happened to change this environment, because your testimony from the Department of Justice and from Multnomah County Assistant District Attorney both indicated that it hasn't been solved at the federal level to help Oregon anyway. So I'm just curious, do you know of something else that Oregon's now ranked better than it used to be?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. And so to your question about what's been done at the federal level, the 2006 report looked at shell corporations and how the filings worked in each and every state and came up with, here are the four worst. There was a 2016 report that also looked at a number of different issues with shell corporations being in there. As far as I know, on that 2016 report, and I've just skimmed it, they didn't really do a 50-state survey or an in-depth look at what's been done. So Oregon hasn't passed anything legislatively since 2006, I believe, on this issue specifically. So, you know, we haven't moved the ball from that 2006 report, as far as I know. At the federal level, they have been taking some actions regarding, you know, terrorist issues and that kind of thing, using bank accounts specifically. So they've been looking at banks specifically. But to us, that is one piece of a very large pie, and they've been able to make some movement there. The issue, and you heard about this from our law enforcement friends on Monday, is we have a, you know, harmonious relationship working with the federal government, but sometimes they are slow, and there's the Bank Secrecy Act, and there's a lot of pretty high bars we have to get that information in order to do our enforcement. And so while there's been some good movement at the federal level, it's you know, probably not enough for us to actually weed out this problem and you know, try to get to the middle of pack for Oregon. So.
Yeah, and just a follow-up. I mean, we did mention that I hate acronyms, but NACUSL has been looking at this issue for 10 years plus. And is there any indication that they've, you know, are close to a national solution to this issue?
Chair Holvey, I tried to look up the NACUSL language, and I think they did come up with a sort of model act, I think, in 2010, and I'm not quite sure on the year on that. But no state has adopted it since. Every state's looked at it and said, no, this isn't going to work for us. So I don't see that as a workable model at the moment.
All right. Question, Representative Bynum.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it'd be either for you, Cheryl, or you. So if you're a small business person and you want to go into business, but you're operating out of your home, how does this change what we're doing now? And does it prevent, let's say this small business you have has some employees, and let's say for some reason there's some sort of dispute that comes up, mm-hmm. The business needs to be served, mm-hmm. and the owner doesn't want to be served at their home. How does this change that? So the business owners need to have some level of privacy, not have the law at their home, but also provide some sort of physical location for which, you know, they can receive legal notices.
Mm-hmm. Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum. So the first point to make is the revealing beneficial ownership in your home address. If you're not paying Oregon taxes, then you would do that, but it would only be available if the Secretary of State would only be able to release that information through a civil, criminal, or administrative subpoena. So it's just for law enforcement that would be able to see that address. Secondly, with the you know, where you would be served piece, you can still have a registered agent at a different address. But the bill talks about if you're a registered agent for 50 or more corporations, that you have to now be licensed and so forth. So it doesn't prohibit having a registered agent as long as they have a physical address.
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, that's a correct assessment in my view, too. Just wanted to note that if you did choose to, under this bill, if you did choose to still have a registered agent and you chose one with 50 or more, you would probably have to, or, well, the agent is responsible for that $500 per location fee, but I would imagine that if they're in business, they would pass that fee on to the people that they were a registered agent for.
Not seeing any other questions at this time. Thank you very much, and I'm sure if we haven't already, we'll be trying to set up a meeting with some of the stakeholders to, you know, try to hash out what looks good in the bill for now and potential amendments to come back to the committee. So thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2191. And as much as I like to move around, let's open up a work session on House Bill 2338.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, this was the measure that was before you February 22nd. Again, it's from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the bill simplifies the criteria and the benefit levels for death benefits that are due to the children of workers who die from on-the-job injury and occupational disease, or they die while permanently or totally disabled. The Dash 1 amendment that is before you also came from the Workers' Comp Division. It requires the director to adjust the amount and the duration of the death benefits for injuries that occurred prior to the effective date. It requires the director to take from the Workers' Benefit Fund to reimburse the insurer or the self-insured employer for any difference between the initial benefit and the adjusted benefit. Directs the insurer to adjust the length of the benefit for a child or the dependent who is attending post-secondary training or education if that person turned 19 and received benefits prior to the effective date. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has been issued on the Dash 1 amendment, and again, the Management Labor Advisory Committee supported this measure with the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2338.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2338. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2338 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2338 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative
Hack?
Yes.
Representative
Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2338, the votes, is passed. And Representative Evans, would you carry this bill for us?
Of course.
Thank you. With that, closed the work session already.
No.
Representative Evans, did you know? Okay, let's close the work session on House Bill 2338. Got time for one more work session?
Yep.
Let's open a work session, House Bill 2572.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure came to you from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It allows the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries to issue a multi-year license to those who qualify, qualifying farm labor contractor or construction labor contractor. You heard the bill February 8th, and again, it was before you on March 8th. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that the licensed labor contractor is other than an employee who has the employee endorsement under ORS 658-411, that any employee who holds that endorsement may not receive the multi-year license. There is no minimal, no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact on that Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2572.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2572. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2572 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2572 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative Fahey.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Yes.
Representative Hearn.
Aye.
Representative Kenever.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum.
Aye.
Chair Holvey.
Aye. House Bill 2572, Amherst City Votes, is passed. And a carrier.
I'll carry them.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2572. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2348.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure comes to you at the request of Secretary of State Jean Atkins, and it increases the portion of the business registry filing fee that is retained by the Secretary of State, increases it from the current $20 to $25 per filing. Currently, no amendments before you.
So, and clarifying, it's former Secretary of State.
Yes, excuse me, former Secretary of State, Jamie Atkins. Thank you.
So, Steve. So, again, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Of course.
Can you speak a little louder today? I'm struggling.
Sorry. How's this?
That's much better.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. Thank you so much for accommodating my schedule and having to be in the other committee and moving this to later in the hearing. I really appreciate it. House Bill 2348 is a bipartisan bill, as it was introduced by former Secretary Atkins and is being supported by the current Secretary of State, Dennis Richardson, and it will provide the Secretary of State's Corporation Division with adequate resources to continue to maintain current operations and expand online services to the business community for better, faster, and more secure services. Oregon's Corporation Division currently gets a $20 piece of all business registry fees, and 20 years ago, we had the $20 piece of business registry fees, at which point business registry fees were significantly lower. They were increased to $50 for a filing in 2004, and then in 2010 they were increased to $100 per filing at the lowest level. There are others for out of state that are higher. And so this bill would increase the share of the fees that are currently paid that goes to the Secretary of State's Corporations Division to adequately fund all the different programs that the legislature has asked us to pursue. In the last 20 years, while the fee percentage that we keep has remained the same, we've reduced staffing from 45 FTE to 35 FTE. And at the same time, we've also added new functions requested by the legislature to provide better services to the state's business community, including expansion of online filing systems like the Oregon Business Registry, Business Express Business Portal, License Directory, the Office of Small Business Assistance, and enhance computer security to protect state computer systems and consumer information. This bill would increase funding for the Corporations Division by approximately $2.9 million in the 2017-19 biennium.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So is this an increase to fees, or is this just utilizing fees that you already charge, just redirecting some of those dollars?
This is not an increase to fees. This is just a redirection of where the funds go.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
didn't see anyone else signed up for House Bill 2348, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2348 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3008.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ready? Okay.
Yes. Give us a summary of the bill, please.
Committee members, this measure prohibits an employer from requiring the employee to submit false information related to the hours worked or the pay received. It establishes a private right of action, allows a court to award actual damages or $1,000 per violation, whichever is greater, as well as injunctive relief, attorney fees, and costs. Allows the BOLI commissioner to assess civil penalty that's not to exceed $1,000 per violation. And there are no amendments today.
Thank you. And Representative Malmstrom, I believe you would like to speak to this bill?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holvey and committee members. My name is Sherry Malmstrom. I would like to speak on House Bill 3008. I'm a state representative from House District 27, and I represent Beaverton and Parsis Southwest Portland. I'm here today to talk to you about a problem that in my 35 years as a registered nurse, I've seen over and over and over again. That problem is wage theft. More specifically, it is the act of employers requiring employees to submit false information on their hours worked or the payment they should receive for the actual hours worked. This form of wage theft happens because either employers are not employing enough workers to adequately do the work, or even worse, they are purportedly taking advantage of their employees to keep costs down. Regardless of why it's happening, this must end. Let me tell you a little bit about what it looks like from a nursing perspective. I started my career as a hospital nurse, and you know, you have a shift and you're doing your shift work and everything's going fine, and you kind of chart at the end of your shift. And as you're getting prepared to do your charting, something happens with one of your patients, you know, and you have to go tend to them. Then you have to go, you know, to finish your charting before you leave. It would be unsafe to not note what you have done. But then you end up staying over. Yet the supervisor says that, you know, your time card is pre-made out, that you're supposed to clock out at a certain time, and you have to ask special permission for asking for overtime rates. If you do that all the time, you're being reviewed and called on the carpet and all sorts of stuff. So people just silently stay after. Many, many times, you know, I'd be sitting there an hour after my shift was over, charting with other exhausted nurses. Finally, when another nurse would come, they would finally get to doing their charts. Same thing happened to me doing public health home visits. You know, you're on track, everything's going fine, you're at your last home visit, and you walk in and the woman greets you at the door with a black eye, and so you're dealing with that, or maybe it's some other crisis, and you don't get out on time. You know, but you know that there's a policy at your agency that they don't, you know, give overtime pay unless you have pre-arranged circumstances. So people just do it and they, you know, mark it because you're being told we don't pay overtime. We don't want to hear about that. So in a profession like nursing where patients are number one priority and every day there's new patients that need individualized attention, one is going to work over their shifted hours from time to time. No, not one single nurse that I know would ever tell a patient, well, I can't help you now. My shift is about to end and I need to get to my charting, so I can't assist you right now. No one's going to do that. They just do what they need to do to help. Nurses deserve to be compensated fairly for the work they do and shouldn't be penalized for giving reasonable attention to patients under their care. House Bill 3008 would ensure that not only nurses, but all Oregon workers receive the pay that they deserve and promote a growing Oregon economy. Our economy depends on all of us working together and treating each other fairly. Responsible business owners and industries that pay their workers fair wages for the actual hours that they work are facing unfair competition from businesses that falsify employee time cards. This bill will help employees and their families that drive our economy ensure that they're being treated fairly and will help protect our businesses from unfair competition. Promoting a fair and equitable economy is a win-win for all Oregonians. Thank you for your time. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Questions, Representative Hurd?
It'd probably be actually better for BOLI. I don't want to pick at the representative. I mean, it sounds good to me. I guess I have a question for BOLI on if we already have laws that already kind of do this. So, because I mean, it would be strange to me that we don't. But
Seems fine.
We'll bring them up after the end of the testimonies.
Okay.
We've got a couple more people to get through, and maybe we'll get some more questions.
Thank you.
Along the way. Representative Barreto, a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with this happening in the nursing business. Are you familiar with it happening anywhere else in the same...
Well, my entire career since I was practically a child has been as a nurse, so I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. But I, having worked in, in many different capacities and talked to lots of different people, other workers that I've worked with, it's not just nurses, people that, have worked in hospitals that they're, orderlies or their housekeepers or whatever. Things happen all the time like that. I don't know what their exact consequences are, what they're told, but they're getting paid an 8 or 10 or 12 hour shift, and they're constantly staying over to finish up. Because in healthcare, just things happen. It's just the nature of the game. And, it's just hard to get overtime approved. It's like a big deal to get overtime approved.
Other questions? Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Up next, Michael Dale and Sarin Metzger. I'm sorry, I can't read the name exactly, and I'm horrible at remembering names, so apologize if I messed it up.
From Bali,
you can go first.
Chairman Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney with Northwest Workers Justice Project and have been working as a lawyer representing low-wage workers for about 40 years in Oregon. I started when I was about 11. This is a problem that we see, Representative Barreto, in a variety of different industries. We see it particularly in low-wage industries because of the imbalance of power that often exists. And in fact, I have a testimony from a worker who had intended to come today but was actually called into work and was not able to come. His full testimony is in your materials, but I'd just like to read just one paragraph because it illustrates what the problem is. He says, good afternoon, my name is Adrian Marcelo Leal, live in the Salem area and work as a landscaper. Some years ago, I worked for a landscaping company that did not treat me and my co-workers fairly. We were told to always round our hours to the nearest 15 minutes, but not in a way that would add time to our hours. So if I arrived at 7:05, I would clock in at 7:15. If I finished my day at 6:11, I would have to sign out at 6 p.m. I worked there for 10 months, and I had to do this every day. So did all my coworkers. There were about 15 of us. This ended up saving the company a lot of money. The bosses said if we wanted to work there, we had to follow this rule. Now, he goes on, you can read it on the filed testimony. This is a problem because in wage and hour litigation, almost always the key fact that's at issue is the hours worked. The employers have an obligation to keep an accurate record of hours. And if they do that, there really wouldn't be very much to resolve in court. It would be clear. But unfortunately, people who want to cheat don't keep good hours either. And so then you get down to a swearing match where it's the credibility of the worker against the employer's records, and that's a tough hill to climb. If you add to that records that perhaps are in the employee's own hand, maybe signed by the employee, it becomes impossible to discredit the employer's hours. You may even be able to convince a jury that, in fact, they were ordered to submit time cards that were in a certain kind of way, but you still have to prove the amount of the unpaid wages. And unless you kept very good records of your own, you're not going to be able to do that. So what we have here is we have a means of engaging in wage theft, and we have a reward system that basically is always going to reward the employer, because employees are not going to be able to prove they were mispaid, and there needs to be something else to balance it out. And this is particularly true because of one of the things that I've experienced as an advocate over the years is that it's not just a question of dollars and cents, it's a question of dignity. If I can tell you, you sign that card or you don't get paid, or you sign that card and you don't have a job, or you don't have a job, then it just sort of underscores the imbalance of power and the lack of dignity that workers have in that kind of situation. So this isn't our bill. It's something we started talking about with Representative Nathanson 2 years ago based on a constituent concern that she had. But it is a good bill, and it ought to move ahead, and we endorse and support it. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Soren Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the 21,000 school support personnel represented by the Oregon School Employees Association. We're here today in support of House Bill 3008. As we understand it, this is common sense legislation to prevent wage theft. OSEA represents, members working in nearly all levels of public education, including Head Start programs, K-12 school districts, ESDs, and community colleges. OSEA members provide the thankless tasks that keep Oregon public schools safe and functional for students, administrators, and teachers throughout the school day. OSEA members work both in public and private sectors and are primarily hourly workers. At our recent, At our recent Legislative Education Day, during a presentation from Oregon's Commissioner of Labor, a room of OSEA members erupted into laughter when they were told they should be taking their lunches and breaks as required by law. As you can imagine, I was surprised to hear this, and this is precisely why I'm here today. OSEA supports improvements to laws preventing wage theft and that allow better access to administrative and legal remedies when employees have been victims of wage theft. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bynum.
Thank you to both of you. Soren, I'm glad you brought that up about employees not taking their breaks on time. Would you say there are barriers in other workplace laws that we have that prevent people from taking the breaks that they need, that prevent people from getting the actual time that's due? I'm an employer, and so I'm wondering if the rounding issue that you mentioned is a matter of record keeping, making it easy to record keep, and then it warps backwards into wage theft. Because I'll have employees that, they think that 6 hours and 11 minutes is 6.11 hours. Do you understand what I'm saying?
You addressed the question.
I asked two questions. I'm sorry. I just had to get it out because my staff is here.
Answer your question, and then I'll
answer mine. I'm so sorry. Representative Bynum, I think Michael Dale will be a better person to answer that question.
Okay.
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, there's nothing actually illegal about rounding as long as you do it in a way that is time neutral. But if you do it in a way that always causes time to be to the credit of the employer, then it's wage theft. And so that was the issue in this particular case. On your question about laws that have to do with why people can't take their breaks, about 5 years ago, roughly, the Oregon Supreme Court decided that you're not entitled to recover wages for breaks that you didn't get. And so basically what we're left with is employees can complain to BOLI about not getting their breaks. BOLI will try to contact the employer and say you really ought to give breaks. They can't actually find people. They don't usually first or second time it happens. Meanwhile, the employer probably has a pretty good idea about who complained about it, and you're in hot water. And by the way, whether there's a fine or whatever happens, all you're ever going to get out of that is for your breaks to be honored at best, and there's no compensation. A couple of years ago, the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft proposed a bill that would have provided a remedy for that. Unfortunately, that bill was unable to move forward. I'd be happy to share it with your office if it's something you're interested in.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony today. And if we could get Paloma from Boley.
Yes.
Good afternoon, and I know you're not signed up to testify on this bill, but I think there was some questions perhaps for you.
Good afternoon.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, Vice Chair Barreto. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, just here to answer questions. Representative Hurd had a question about whether or not there were other laws that relate to this. It's not specific to the time card, but under our wage and hour laws, all employees are entitled to be paid the wages that they earn, and that means any time that they are working, regardless of what is written on a pay stub, they're entitled to be paid for hours. In fact, the employer has an obligation to, if they don't prevent the worker from providing a benefit to the employer is on the hook for those wages. So that's the current state of the law.
Follow up, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. thank you for that. Another question I have is, I see there's two different spots where it references $1,000. One is damages awarded by the court, but the other refers to the director may enforce upon the employer up to a $1,000 penalty for the violation. Where does that money go?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, generally civil penalties go to the common school fund after they're collected.
One more question.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you believe this legislation, if it's successfully passed through, is going to help the enforcement mechanisms of these issues?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, it's hard to answer. You know, it's another element of making sure that employers aren't requiring employees to submit false records. But again, proving that a record is false, it's sort of the same, puts us essentially in a similar position where we are now, because the employee has to keep records and has to be able to prove that it's false.
Right.
Other questions? So I guess I'll try one myself. So if a worker is entitled to the hours worked or to be paid for those hours worked, and there is no penalty for falsifying the pay stub, how do they figure out what the hours worked were? I mean, if they were to bring a case to you, if there is no, you know, I guess, are you just relying on the worker to document it, and then the employer has their own time card, and who wins when they both have different opinions?
Chair Holvey, when an employee is bringing a claim for unpaid wages, the employer then has the burden of showing that they were not entitled to it. You know, if we were doing an investigation, I think if the standard was clear, there were other workers who were saying, oh, no, we always come in and start at 7, but we don't clock in till 8, I think that's an evidence that we could rely on.
But to follow up with that, if the employer's time card showed that they were clocking in at 8, they'd be falsifying that time card, but there's no penalty for that.
Chair Holvey, under current law, that's correct.
But the worker would be, and if Bowley found that it was a legitimate claim for the workers, they would get paid their wages, but nothing beyond that. And
that's correct.
Representative Barreto.
You know, that brings up an thank you, Mr. Chair. So that brings up kind of an interesting comment then. It's just the worker's word against the employer's word. I mean, it could be they were filling out the time card, but they said the employer's filling it out. I mean, all of this seems to be predicated on whose word you believe, whether it's the employer or the employee, and then where do you go with that? Is it always the employer who's got the burden of proof?
Mm-hmm. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, yeah. It's really an evidentiary test for the courts. If a claim goes to court for Bowley, if the claim goes to Bowley, it's looking at the evidence, talking to witnesses.
Representative Hack?
I'm good.
Right. I know Michael Dale, you had something to add to this, so I'll have you come back up.
Michael Dale, in Chair Holvey and Representative Hurd, thanks for the opportunity to clarify this. It's actually the employee who always has the burden of showing that the wages are unpaid. And you may be able to create enough of, particularly if there are a number of workers involved, you may be able to create strong enough testimony to convince a jury that that in fact the time cards were forcibly signed falsely. But that still doesn't prove how long you worked. And if it were a case that you regularly came in 15 minutes early, then that would be simple enough. But if it was like on one day it was 5 minutes and on another day it was like 20 minutes and you don't remember, you don't have any records of it, you're still on the hook for proving how much you got underpaid, and if you can't prove that, you're not going to get your wages, even though, as Park says, the law says you're entitled to it. You still have to prove it, and that's the problem. And if you have the burden of proof, and the employer has a timesheet that you signed that says you came in at 9 o'clock, and you're saying you came in at 8 o'clock, well, you know, I don't know if you're going to meet your burden of proof, and that's a tough thing in these cases. So the idea would be, at least if you can establish that you were required to fill out these timesheets erroneously, at least there would be that penalty, even if you can't prove exactly how much the unpaid wages were. Thank you.
Other questions? If I'm hearing this right, that from the employer's end, and I got to imagine that, you know, 99% of the employers aren't falsifying time cards.
Absolutely not.
To cheat workers to start with, but
I would even say that the grand majority of people who are cheating workers don't engage in this practice. This is an extreme and it's not unusual, but it's not as common as the practice of cheating workers.
So what would be the for that 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 employers that engage in falsifying the time card? What's the, I guess, disincentive for them not to do that? Is double negative perhaps, but you know, if all they're subject to is actually paying what was owed at the end of the day, you know, what's the incentive for them to change their practice?
This is the problem. There is no disincentive. Or there is no incentive to change.
Chair Holvey, I would challenge the assertion that Bowley never assesses penalties. there are circumstances when in which we do, but you know, we're usually what we're trying to get is a resolution. When we've got an employer who is refusing to do what they're supposed to do under the law, certainly sometimes we do assess penalties. It just depends on the circumstances of the case.
Yes, and I wasn't making that assertion, but I thought that you said that there really wasn't a penalty for falsifying the time card, that the workers just do the wages. And so the remedy in this situation would be that the worker gets the wages that were due for the hours worked, but there wouldn't be a penalty for falsifying the time card. I thought that's what your testimony was.
Chair Holby, there is no, currently, under current law, there's no penalty directly tied to this proposal that would link to falsifying a record. There are penalties for not paying wages.
Okay. So in this case, I'm following up. So in this case, that the employer, then if they falsified, they have to pay the wages due for those hours worked. And you're saying that that's not all that could happen. An employer could also get an additional penalty from BOLI for that.
Chair Holby, that's correct.
Okay, that's so I misunderstood you the first time. All right. Any other questions? I think I beat that one up pretty bad. So, okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today. And that's the end of my sign-up sheet, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3008. And Jan, do I have anything else left to do on the calendar? That's.
I'll just point out that House Bill 2855. This requesters of that measure are asking for an amendment, so that isn't being dealt with today.
Okay, and so I suppose we'll reschedule that, not knowing if
right,
it will be
it will
ready for Monday. So. We'll reschedule that for another date in the future. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.